David Daniels, and this is the first of our series of conversations with David, where we will be focusing a number of sessions on the instinctual subtypes. My special guest for this series is Peter O'Hanrahan, who is the director of the Enneagram Professional Training Program and a long-time student of the subtypes, actually a 29-year student and world-renowned expert on this topic area. So I'm welcoming Peter O'Hanrahan. And we have three guests also, which I'll introduce in a little while, who represent each of the three instinctual energies, and as we go on, and they will be participants with us on this. This first part of the series is an overview of the subtypes and the instincts, and exploring how they relate to the three centers of intelligence, and we'll concentrate mainly on the generic aspects of these subtypes, not particularly on the type-related facets, but we'll get into this. So, Peter, welcome to this first of our series, and please comment on your experience and interest in the subtypes.
Yes, well, David, I'm glad we're doing this because it's just a fascinating subject, and I think very essential to our use of the Enneagram. Some people think, well, subtypes, it's this kind of interesting, you know, down the road, if you're really interested in the Enneagram, you can get the subtypes. But actually, it's really kind of this central aspect of how we show up in the world, and it's also a very important part of our work on ourselves. And when I was first learning about the Enneagram in Berkeley in the 1970s, the subtypes were followed very close after. And we're really seen as kind of a key to being able to find and be aware of how we were using our type structure in daily life.
Right, and you know, they're very rooted in our being, and they're very ancient in a sense that they go way back in our evolution. And we describe three of these basically that we all share in, and the first one is called self-preservation. And this means meeting the physical needs that we all experience. Needs around safety, security, comfort, protection, well, adequate basic resources such as food, shelter, and warmth. This is absolutely vital for ourselves and the people that we identify with and are close with. It's a very important aspect, and we all have this. The second is called the social instinct. We're a group living species, and so we adapt and we function vis-a-vis community and group membership and participation. And some of the issues around social subtype or social instinct are role, status, the sense of social acceptance, being included, participation with others, and a certain amount of companionship and fellowship that we all need. And the third instinct is called the one-to-one or sexual, and it does not mean that there are sexual behaviors directly associated with these more intimate behaviors, but it's the connection to really vital relationships that we have, important relationships, and to just the one-on-one tendency that we all share at least some in. This is the sharing or bonding with special others, the expressing intensity in one-to-one relationships, sexual intimacy is appropriate, being attractive, and the closeness that we share, and a sense of union emerging with special others. And I would like to say that these three basic instincts correspond really closely to what the social scientists call, you know, three basic ingredients of relationship. And one is in the self-preservation, these things are called support functions, instrumental functions, task functions, the things that we manage to do to survive day to day in our self-preservation instinct. And they're called friendship and companionship or affiliation functions in the social domain, so that a partner, for instance, is a good friend and someone that you do things together with and share interests. And then the one-to-one relationship in the social sciences is referred to as affection or intimacy functions. And they can be, you know, rather intense functions. But we all need all three of these in our vital relationships to some degree. The task functions, our support functions, the social functions of friendship and companionship, affiliation, and of the intimate functions of affection and closeness with specific individuals that are vital to us. So that's just by way of a little background. Peter, what would you add to this?
Well, I think it's interesting to see how the expression of the instincts, how our instinctual lives have developed in the modern age. They go back so far. I mean, they're rooted in millions of years of history. And, our, of course, our development as a as mammals and the whole, limbic system and attachment system. And so there's really been a very long history here. And now we're still kind of working it out. It's like, how are we going to manage these very powerful instinctual drives in the modern world? And on the one hand, they're all survival related. I mean, we've got to have all three. Self-preservation is pretty clear in the sense that, if you don't have enough food and warmth and shelter, you're not going to survive. But as you mentioned, the social instinct is also a survival strategy because we've evolved as group, living together in groups and communities, and that's been a big part of our success as a species. And of course, the one-to-one, obviously, it's very basic element of the one-to-one is if people don't have sex and procreate, we won't survive in that way either. But beyond the survival level, I think that there's, kind of wonderful ways that these drives can be expressed in life. For example, the self-preservation, yes, it's about material security and having enough food and money and like that, but there's also a quality of generativity that comes. It's kind of like a nourishing of all the different aspects of life regarding family and neighborhood and growing things and building the infrastructure of the society and all the transportation and the shopping and the insurance systems. And all of that seems to me to be tied directly to the self-preservation instinct. So on the one hand, a very clear survival strategy, and on the other, a way that people can really expand and, express their vitality on the field of human relationship.
Right, and what would you add in regard to the social and one-to-one instincts?
Right, well, social, we're challenged to kind of arrange ourselves to form ever more complex social systems. And I think everybody's aware of that, how incredibly complex the modern world has become. And we're doing our best to cooperate with one another, sometimes better and worse. But to cooperate on the level of a town, of a city, of a state, a country, and also now in the kind of the whole interconnected world. And so we're being challenged to kind of make a very important shift in the way that we express our social instinct to not just say, well, it's, I'm part of this tribe, but these people, they're my people, and those other guys down the road, they're other, but to really expand the way that we express our social instinct to be more inclusive and be more welcoming of people, everywhere. And that's, of course, one of the very crucial challenges facing us today. We have to make that transition. In terms of the one-to-one or the sexual instinct, I'm just aware of how many people I know who are using that, the energy of that instinct for their work and especially for their creativity. It's like a certain intensity there. It's like the pursuit of excellence in a number of different endeavors, people who really want to become the best that they can be. And so I think there's something about drawing upon this this one-to-one or sexual instinct energy to be creative, and also for some it helps fuel their spiritual development because, of course, the union experience, we talk about the one-to-ones kind of seeking a union experience, not only with another human being, but perhaps with divine spirit.
Right.
So I'm just saying that, at one level it's all about survival, but at another level it's about creativity and generativity, and it's about, making the world work.
Good. Thank you, Peter. before I introduce our three guests that represent each of the instinctual subtypes, I just want to go over a few other items that are important about the instinctual energies. First is just the basic definition of instinct is that innate unlearned survival behaviors. Now, with the human being, these are not literally all totally innate and unlearned because we are so exposed to environment for such a long time at such an early stage, actually when the fetus, you know, begins to form and develop in utero. So, but there are these basic rooted behaviors, you know, that do have this innate component to them at least. And they're certainly present at birth. It's been taught that, you know, that they develop along different lines as the infant progresses, but you can see self-preservation in very rudimentary ways right at birth in the grasping reflex, in the sucking reflex, for example, or two ways. The social manifests very early. It's a little harder to determine, but, you know, a little 8 weeks infant that's smiling, everybody surrounds a little infant and goo-goos at them. I just goo-goo. And that's like social instinct right there very early. And that smile and you know, the way the infant responds to kind of environmental changes that, you know, are kind of a social environmental context. And then, of course, the one-to-one relationship is right there at birth. There's huge evidence that supports that the bonding and connection to the mother is enormously different than any kind of experience with a stranger. This is physiologically determined, and it's required right from the very beginning in order for any decent development. So all three of these instincts, in their very rudimentary form, are right there at birth, and then they develop more in a sequential way. The self-preservation is there more in the first 18 months or so of life. And just and then the social, as soon as a little child gets wheeled, so to speak, and starts running around exploring the world, they have to be socialized. And so that takes some more precedence around the period of 18 to 36 months. This is just a range. It can be extended further than that. And then the real one-to-one intensity or more bonding that becomes more specific and more relationship-oriented, where the parent or other figures have a right of their own, so to speak. You see them as a separate entity. That develops, you know, along about 36 months to 72 months or so. So they're both present at birth, and then they have a developmental chain to them with self-preservation, social, and one-to-one in sort of in that order. Peter, do you have something to add to that?
Well, I think that's correct. I think the instincts are, you know, in large part hardwired. I mean, it's you know, it's part of our biological development, and the, you know, babies show up with those instincts, or at least instinct potentials already in place, and then they're, of course, developed in the early family situation. And that's also interesting to look at too. It's like, well, you know, why does one instinct become more developed or more emphasized over another? And you know, I think there's just a lot for us to learn by looking at, you know, so what was, I mean, this is not new, you know, it's part of you know, psychoanalytic psychology, of course, but to understand, you know, what was our development in early childhood, and how did that affect the development of our three instincts, and then how does that influence our lives today?
Right, and I would like to, at this time, introduce our three guests with the background that each of us tends to lead with one of the three instincts. We have all three of these, and so we have one guest that leads with the one-to-one, one that leads with the social, one that leads with self-preservation. And so I'd like to have our guests introduce themselves and what their career is doing currently and how they know they tend to lead with a particular instinct. Now, remember, we have all three, and it's easy to stereotype oneself that, well, I'm self-preservation or I'm one-to-one, but actually we have all three. It's just that we lead with one, sometimes strongly so. So I'd like to introduce Evangeline Welch, who leads with the self-preservation instinct. And Evangeline, say a little about both what you're doing in regard to the Enneagram and how your self-preservation manifests itself as a lead instinct.
Yes, thank you, David. I am the marketing director for the Enneagram Professional Training Program. I'm also have completed the trainings and use the Enneagram then both in my creative work and also out in the world. I also facilitate workshops. As a self-preservation subtype, one of the things I think it really shows up for me is that I've been self-employed as a business owner for 20 years, and I've always chosen to work out of my home. And I've always managed to set up my office in the very best view of my home place, so like a very important view so I can look out in the world and really enjoy my space. I always create a very comfortable and warm home environment. I like that place of being able to come home and know that this is my space, and I've created in a way that where I can feel like I can thrive and be creative and do meaningful work.
No, I love the way you put this too. You happen to be an Enneagram type 4, what we call the romantic, but that you love the beauty and the creativity of being able to have an environment that's really, really lovely, probably ties also back to your type. What other ways do you know that you lead with the self-preservation?
I also notice it in terms of when I'm just paying attention to what my thoughts are during the day, it's amazing how much attention goes to my safety or what I think might make me feel more secure or comfortable around whether it's considerations around driving on a freeway or whether I'm thinking about what my next home might be like. And part of that does sort of connect in with that fourness of kind of thinking about maybe what's missing. But I think still the focus is on more of these self-preservation needs and not so much on, say, my social network of friends or my even into my intimate relationship.
Thank you. And I want to turn now to Catherine Tornboom, who leads with the social instinct. And Catherine, if you would say a little bit about your work and its relationship to the Enneagram and how you know you lead with the social instinct.
Well, thanks, David. It's so obvious how I lead with it that the minute I tell you what I do for a living, I am an organizational development consultant, and my entire work career has been focused on how it is groups can function most effectively or most powerfully, whatever their goals are, whatever their primary mission. And I also volunteer with the Association of Enneagram Teachers in the Narrative Tradition, you know, the Association of EPTP graduates. And this is the second time now I've organized the Asilomar Conference, which is in June of 2008. And my concern always goes to how can we create dynamics in a group that allow each member to contribute to their greatest ability. And I've thought of that ever since I can remember. If you take a look at my history, I was organizing people big time by high school, president of this and coordinating that, creating groups where they didn't exist before. It started a little bit earlier, but my documentation starts in high school. And you know, when I think about how early influences, there is a sense I have that my family wasn't quite together in the way they really should be. So I can remember trying to my siblings and my parents feeling like I had a major responsibility in helping the family be together in ways that would be better. So it's just been my attention, and I don't even have to. I can be dead tired, totally exhausted, I sit with a group of people and my antenna are up going, well, you know, if we just shifted slightly, if we considered this order, maybe if we stopped a moment and took a breath, you know, my mind constantly goes to how it is my people around me can function better.
Right, and you know, also indicating a little bit of your type, which happens to be type 6, the Enneagram, which is very dutiful and, you know, wants to be a good team player usually and is looking out, you know, for what could go wrong and wanting to build a better community. Does that all fit?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Well, let me turn now to Polly Turner, who's leads with the one-to-one instincts, and Polly, ask you about how you relate to the Enneagram, what you're doing, and describe the kind of fundamental generic aspect of your one-to-one relating.
Yes, David, thank you. It's amazing listening to Evangeline and Catherine, because it's so clear that I'm a one-to-one. When Evangeline speaks to where her thoughts go daily, I'm thinking on that. And my thoughts go all day long to relationships, all the different relationships I have and how I'm doing in those relationships and what I might do to further them or take care of them or be more honest in them. It's I don't think about the whole group. In fact, when I hear Catherine speak, I'm like, I don't really know about the whole big picture, but I really know about the excitement of connecting in on a one-to-one relationship with someone. And I realize in my work in these last 3-4 years, as I've been sharing the Enneagram system, the power and excitement of it, I do it mostly in one-to-one conversations, helping people discover where they fall. And as I've moved into teaching classes, I realized I had to really shift from how do I relate to the whole group if I just really want to have the one-on-one connection. So that's been a journey to be able to do that. I realize sometimes I just see the group as one other unit, and then I relate and sort of get the juice going with the whole group. So it's still really the one-on-one, so that there's an excitement about connecting, and there's an intensity. And if there's not that, I'll create it a little bit. I'll make something happen so that the juice is flowing. I love to, you know, have eye contact with people, anticipate what's going to be going on. And then the downside is often I'll take things really personally if something's happened, and it's been so helpful in the understanding of the Enneagram system that things aren't personal to me when someone else is behaving in a certain way. I always thought it was personal to me. And then, of course, a little bit from my type as a type 1, what have I done wrong? So in relationship, have I not gotten it right? And what have I done wrong? And any upset that would come around that. So having to put a lot of energy into first doing that and then quieting it when I see how much energy gets caught up in this the intensity around relationships.
Well, thank you. I was going to just mention, yes, you're type 1 on the Enneagram, and
yes,
you included that. I'm just going to make another comment here before we close this session and go and give you a preview of the next session. The question comes up, are there other instincts? And of course there are other instincts, but one in particular we think is important, or I think is important, is what's called the exploratory instinct, that little children just want to explore the world. They want to. It's a drive. You can't stop them. Your two-year-old wants to know everything. He wants to be into, especially the things that you don't want the two-year-old to be in or the three-year-old. And they're always asking all these why questions. And sometimes as we get older, that gets crushed down, that instinct. But it's also called the growth instinct, to develop, that there's a drive, if you will, in human beings to develop, actually, that can get pretty constricted as we try to cope with the regular world. But there's a powerful exploratory instinct. I just wanted to mention that. So I want to thank you, and we're going to come back in our second session and explore a little bit about the neurobiology of the instincts, and then turn to the question of our guest then, and with Peter, of, well, why study these subtypes? What's so important about it? What difference does it make in relationships, et cetera? So we'll be back with that in our second session. And thank you for listening today, and we'll be back with you in our second session.